Johnstone Foundation presents a plenary session entitled The Search for Buried Treasure in Mormon History, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Good evening and welcome to the 7th Annual Sunstone Theological Symposium. My name is Peggy Fletcher and I'm the chairperson of this event. And also connected to the Sunstone Foundation. I would like to welcome you, and I would like to ask, it was interesting, last year I asked for a show of hands of how many people for whom this was their first time at Sunstone, and I would like to ask that question again. How many people are here tonight for the first time? Wow. Can you hear all the way in the back there? No, huh? Great. Okay, how about now? Better? Okay. Well, for all of those for whom this is the first time, again, let me welcome you. And let me tell you a few things about Sunstone and explain a few of the frustrations you're going to have in the next 3 days and help prepare you for that. First of all, I would like to direct you to the statement of purpose that's printed in the program. And let me read that to you because I think it's really important that people understand what we're here about. Let me read the scripture first. Truly the light is sweet and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. The Sunstone Foundation is committed to the idea that study and discussion of religion are critical to the improvement of our common life. We strenuously believe that thorough examination of all religious ideas can serve to sharpen our moral faculties, and to help eliminate needless hostility among the various groups. We do not suppose that greater understanding will necessarily produce unanimity or even harmony. Our goal is rather to approach all questions and issues, no matter how complex, with intelligence and goodwill. We invite persons from the entire spectrum of belief to join with us in the process. So that's what Sunstone is all about, and the symposium particularly. We do invite your participation. This year we've enlarged the amount of time for questions in each session and enlarged the amount of time in between sessions so that people can ask more questions and can become involved in every session. We hope that each session will have some amount of time for that dialogue to begin. But as we said in our statement of purpose, the one thing that we don't permit anywhere at this symposium is an attack on anyone's belief or any tradition, any faith, or anyone else's church that we choose to exclude from our discussion. Everything else in the spirit of goodwill and good fun is permissible. Similarly, if you've been here before, you know that a major frustration, which has been told to me at least 100,000 times, is why do you put all the good sessions at the same time? Well, we do on purpose. But that's another story. My answer to that is a couple of things. One is there are tapes available of the sessions that you will miss, and so be aware of that. And also, we ask that no one else tape it. We have a taping company for whom this is copyrighted taping, and so really it's not fair for a lot of little tape recorders to be taping. And some of the participants have asked that their remarks not be taped, and I'm asking all of you to respect that. Similarly, some of the titles might be a little confusing to you, and you may not know exactly how best to choose from among the various sessions, and I would direct your attention to the abstracts, the group of abstracts which are given out at the registration table. Last year, many, many people did not pick up the abstracts and didn't realize that there is more information about every session than only the title. So please, do get one of those sets of abstracts and don't complain to me about not knowing how to choose. Also, let me direct your attention to the addendum. Every program of this magnitude has got changes and cancellations and room switches and title changes and that sort of thing. So any of the changes that are on the program are printed on the addendum, unless they happen tomorrow or something that we didn't know about. in advance. Actually, that's all I have to say. I wanted only to welcome you and invite your participation and hope that you have, as we all will, 3 full days and evenings of the greatest discussions ever. Let me now turn the podium over to David J. Whitaker, who will be our host this evening and moderator of this panel. He is the curator of the Archives of the Mormon Experience at Brigham Young University. He is the book review editor of BYU Studies and received his doctorate in American history. Here's David.
During the last year or so, students of Mormon history have sensed that, in terms of even a minor way, there have been some interesting mental depth charges dropped into the field of Mormon history. Some, I suspect, continue to explode. Some have not yet for students of Mormon history. The past, as one author has indicated, seems to lurk in the underbrush, ready to spring out upon us unwary passers-by at any given time. Probably in no other, in no greater way is that statement true than the topic at hand for our session tonight. All of you, of course, probably wouldn't be here if you, at least tonight, if you hadn't heard within the last year anyway, rumors and, in fact, generally unauthorized until recently, copies of new documents in Mormon history circulating among students of Mormon history that have raised profound, if not at least significant questions about pre and as well as post-1830 Mormonism. It has led some students to argue that we somehow have begun to sense that maybe pre-1830 Mormonism is somewhat of a dark ages compared to at least the new light that some of these documents seem to be suggesting on Mormon origins. Of course, whether that's true or not remains to be seen in the research and the thinking and the discussions like that will go on tonight. But our session tonight, in general, is entitled The Search for Buried Treasure in Mormon History. We have 3 distinguished individuals with us. We'd like to proceed with their papers, and then following that, what we'd like to do is have some participation from the audience. We've established a microphone in the center, and we'd ask those of you, primarily in the past, we've had difficulty hearing questions in the congregation. Congregation in the audience, in which that may be more appropriate than we imagine. And then so at the conclusion of Levi Peterson's presentation, then we'll go to a question-answer format, and we'll try. Can you still hear in the back? Is that all right? We'll ask each of the speakers to stand as close as they can to the microphone so their voices will carry. Let me briefly introduce each of our presenters this evening. In the order of their presentation. First will be Jess Grosbeck, who is a psychiatrist and currently a psychoanalyst in private practice in California. He was trained at the Jung Institute of San Francisco. He has carried on research in both primitive healing and modern psychotherapy, and of course has had a long interest in Mormon history, as early articles in Dialogue, for example, would suggest. He now lives in California, carrying titles of Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of California at Davis, as well as Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Utah and Adjunct Professor of Psychology at BYU. He is married and has 5 children, and his talk will be Joseph Smith and the Shaman's Vision. Our second paper will be by Ron Walker. Ron probably doesn't need as much of an introduction to most of you. Ron, of course, has been very active in the field of Mormon history. His doctorate's from the University of Utah. Writing particularly on the Godbeites. He currently is associate professor and a member of the Joseph Ealing Smith Institute for Church History at Brigham Young University. He's also associate editor of Brigham Young University Studies. He is married and has 7 children. His talk will be Joseph Smith, the Palmyra Seer. Our third presentation will be The Smoldering Gift, Treasure Hunting Joseph as God's Anointed. This will be given by Levi Peterson. Received his bachelor's and master's from BYU, his PhD in English from the University of Utah. He is currently professor of English at Weber State College. He's a native of Snowflake, Arizona. His most recent work is Canyons of Grace, a collection of short stories that you've probably already heard of. He is currently working on a biography of Juanita Brooks. So without any further ado, let's proceed to those three papers, and then we'll get involved in some dialogue between audience and participants.
I want to be sure to speak closely. Can you hear in the back? Yeah. Okay. I'd like to thank the following people for the help with this paper. Marvin Hill, Michael Marquardt, Scott Dunn, Brent Metcalf, Dave Berger, my friend and colleague for many years, Benjamin Taylor, my son, David Grosbeck, and last but not least, my wife, Sharon, who is home doing more important things, getting ready for our daughter's wedding to be next week. I might add, my daughter, though, is here tonight, too. Joseph Smith and the Shaman's Vision, a psychoanalytic exploration in Mormonism. With the recent finding of the Salamander Letter of Martin Harris, new questions concerning the origin of Mormonism, and particularly the life of Joseph Smith, are being asked. It has always been my impression that a specific understanding of the Smith family relationships are central to a more complete comprehension of the young prophet in the making. It will be my intention in this paper to utilize the insights of psychiatry, psychoanalysis, and anthropology to carry out a psychohistorical investigation into the life of Joseph Smith, which to my knowledge has not been attempted. Specifically, I will rely on the methodology and approach of C.G. Jung, that's J-U-N-G, School of Psychoanalysis, Analytical Psychology. The calling of a shaman. In the historical investigations of Joseph Smith, a number of paradigms have emerged. First and foremost is that in which the devout Mormon sees him only as the divine prophet. Juxtaposed to that is the paradigm in which anti-Mormons see him as a charlatan, perhaps a trickster, at best a deceiver who filled his own grandiose needs. And of course, there are many views in between. I would like to suggest a new paradigm by which to view Joseph Smith. That paradigm is to see him as a shamanic personality, or as an individual who expressed and lived out the archetypal pattern of the ancient shaman, holy man, or healer. With an in-depth understanding of the role of the shaman, it is my contention that all of the data coming forth concerning Joseph, with his involvement on the one hand with magic and the occult, and on the other with his later spiritual and religious strivings, can best be integrated within this model. Carl Jung, the great 20th century psychiatrist, described archetypes as being those universally deep, initially unconscious patterns of behavior and psychic functioning that emerge in the psychic lives of particular individuals to aid them in adaptation and growth during life crises. In reviewing systems of healing and religion in the history of the world, one finds that the oldest form of these archetypal patterns, and apparently worldwide in distribution, is that of shamanism. It has been defined as that particular type of medicine man, or holy man, who, via the controlled use of trance or ecstasy, communicates directly with the spirits and realities of the other world for the benefit of his community. His power was derived from direct experience, not indirect, such as priests or medicine men claim. His particular function is to heal those splits and synthesize the polarities that create the intolerable tensions in human life. Because the polarities are so profound and seemingly irreconcilable, the shaman will often draw upon the deepest symbols within a culture system, attempting to unite that which is most primitive and elemental with that which is ultimate and sublime for a grand new synthesis. This paper will attempt to present the view that Joseph Smith responded to a time of great crisis, both in his family and his local culture, by becoming a shaman. Primarily, he became a synthesizer as a prophet and healer. In fact, it was precisely in synthesizing what appeared to be an impossible set of polarities that he was able to create a remarkable religious system that has aided millions with similar struggles. How he first did this in his own life and within his own family circle needs delineation. You might now turn to the chart that was passed out to you, the one sheet I have summarized on one side a few brief phrases to highlight the data upon which this paper is based, and I will not take a lot of time with it. In 1802, Joseph Sr. and Lucy moved to Randolph, Connecticut to enter the mercantile business. Apparently, the ginseng root was a herb that was quite popular, selling at a high price as a remedy for plague in China. Joseph Sr. invested in this root to the tune of $3,000. In the process, he lost this by failing to act soon enough. And the person who cheated him out of this came back drunk and said, "Here's the gold and silver of Joseph Sr." The loss of this investment by Joseph Sr. had far-reaching consequences for himself and the family. Indebtedness became virtually their perpetual state. They moved 7 times in 14 years, with debts continually plaguing them. Evidence suggests that he suffered a clinical depression that hampered his ability to function. Psychologically, in his depression, bitterness, and resultant economic destitution, he most likely never got over the loss of the ginseng root incident. From then on, it was as though he was a dreamer who detached himself from reality, becoming preoccupied and fascinated with money digging, probably in an attempt to recoup a loss he could never fully accept. Through money digging, he expected to become rich and to find what he had always hoped for his family. In this state, there appeared to be the habitual and chronic abuse of alcohol. That this must have had a shattering effect can be noted from the following quotation from Joseph Sr. himself. I'm quoting now from Richard Bushman's book on the early life of Joseph. The vicissitudes of life seemed to have weighed heavily on Joseph Sr. In a patriarchal blessing given to Hiram, 9 December 1834, Joseph Sr. commended Hiram for the respect he paid his father despite difficulties. In quotes, though he, and this is Joseph Sr. referring to himself giving the blessing, though he has been out of the way through wine, thou hast never forsaken him nor laughed him to scorn. Since there is no evidence of intemperance after the organization of the church, Joseph Sr. likely referred to a time before 1826 when Hiram married and left home. If one were looking at this data clinically, he would hypothesize that money digging and alcohol were the means he chose to overcome his economic woes and depression. The hope always was to find a treasure. It is felt that the emotional state of Joseph Sr. had a significant impact on Lucy's own religious quest and also her attempts to save him spiritually. That Joseph Sr. and his family, particularly Alvin and young Joseph, were deeply involved in money digging cannot now be denied. Some neighbors of the Smiths claim that magical practice was their only real business. The split between magic and religion as a way of life must have been extremely great, especially as it was expressed between Joseph Sr. and Lucy. After the family moved to Palmyra in 1818, Alvin carried much of the family responsibility. He led the way building the log house and then later desired to build a bigger home for his parents, as well as pay for the farm. Here the picture of Joseph Sr.'s serious problems stand out. The description that Joseph later gave of his brother Alvin is revealing. He states, in quotes, "He was the oldest member of my father's family. He lived without spot from the time he was a child. From the time of his birth, he never knew mirth. He was candid and sober and never did play. He minded his mother and father in toiling all day. He was one of the soberest of men." This certainly could imply that Alvin himself may have been burdened with his parents' depression, particularly that of his father. Often in families, when there is a serious illness in one or both parents, one child in particular is called and marked out, often unconsciously, to become the healer, the reconciler, and carrier of the burdens that cannot be borne by the parents. This is a nearly universal theme in the study of the dynamics of family systems. In the Smith family, it is opined that the individual early on chosen was Alvin. On 15 November 1823, a tragedy occurred. Alvin, after the ingestion of some food, became ill and died suddenly. The tragedy of Alvin's death cannot be overemphasized. Clearly, he was the mediator. For young Joseph, he was the ideal, and most likely that of the other children. After the death of Alvin, the family members were so pained and depressed they could not talk further about the plates. The question needs to be asked, why? Most likely it was due to Alvin's deep involvement with the plates, and any discussion of them only reminded them of him. A further blow came to the family when apparently a minister claimed that Alvin had gone to hell because he was not baptized. Lucy herself probably felt that this was true, and that even all the family was going to hell because they were not members of a church. It is most striking, as Marvin Hill notes, that shortly after that, Lucy took Hiram, Sophronia, and joined the Presbyterian Church. Joseph Sr. and Joseph Jr. did not. Here the split in the family was objectified more than ever before. As the family mourned, complications ensued. Someone had apparently been playing on the family's grief and suggested that Alvin's remains had been exhumed. On 30 September 1824, Joseph Sr. published a statement to discredit reports that Alvin's body had been exhumed and dissected. He apparently dug up the grave and found the body to be undisturbed. Joseph Sr. was so angry at the minister who had claimed Alvin had gone to hell that he refused to become involved in church activity, but Lucy did get involved. When Alvin died, the family was in disarray, and all the data seems to illustrate that the grief they experienced must have been profound. If Alvin was already the designated healer of the family split, who was to take his place? It is clear that young Joseph became that individual. Prophetically, he fulfilled an earlier, strange, precognitive dream of his father in 1819. I won't take the time to go into it, but in that dream, his father, lame, went to a garden and was healed. And this is interesting because that dream followed the 3 years of being an invalid of young Joseph, who had a leg operation and an infection. And if one examines that dream, I think one sees in it the threads of Joseph being the potential leader of the family. Further, Joseph's marriage to Emma brought affection and emotional support to replace what had been given to Alvin. He experienced depression at the loss of Alvin, and he was later to say, in quotes, that he had to get married because the death of his brother had made him so very lonely, end of quote. In attempting to unite his parents, he at first clearly sided with his father. The fact that he apparently got drunk with him and sided with him in not joining the church, as Hiram and Samuel had done, suggests his clear-cut identification with Joseph Sr. With the death of Alvin, I speculate if there was a time the parents almost divorced, it was then. Money digging and the slippery treasure. Joseph Sr., in selling the ginseng herbs to make his fortune, hoped to gain gold and silver. But when he lost the herbs by hesitation, his treasure slipped away and he became a loser. Though never successful in finding treasure, he endlessly continued to dig. When treasure was never found, it was explained as not being done just right, or malevolent demons or forces caused it to slip away. The rationale in a number of accounts surrounding reports that chests of treasure would slip down into the earth now become more understandable as we attempt to probe the unconscious mind of Joseph Sr. One could postulate that when these sessions of great expectation, a nighttime of digging and struggle, ended with the treasure slipping away, Joseph Sr. would turn to other spirits, alcohol, to mourn his loss. I'd like to now just again briefly summarize two important other visions of Joseph Sr. The first one was in 1811, when he, in the dream, was in a barren field in an inanimate world. There he found a treasure, and he began to eat of the treasure, and the treasure was giving him wisdom. But suddenly he was interfered with by a number of animals who came and chased him away. This will be important later. His last dream in 1819 or 20, his seventh vision, was one in which a man came to call upon him and tell him that there was one thing he lacked in order to secure salvation. Joseph Sr. stated, "I earnestly desired to know what it was I still lacked. I requested him to write this thing on a piece of paper. He said he would do so. I sprang to get some paper, but in my excitement, I awoke." End of vision. These dreams, as most of them do if you read them, suggest the dissatisfaction in Joseph Sr.'s life. Turning now to the thesis of Joseph Smith as a shamanic personality, the following is important. The shamanic complex is suggested by those individuals who have a serious illness in early life, and in order to resolve it, need to solve a serious psychological problem, which in turn reorders their entire life. They do this vis-a-vis healing others. Joseph certainly had this, as he had a leg operation which produced a limp, and he was invalided for 3 years. The far-reaching consequences of this on his later development have never been emphasized enough. It most likely affected his identity, including core elements of his sense of masculinity and sexuality. Second, shamans need to face strange ordeals with initiatory rites that involve dealing with the powers of darkness. Joseph certainly fulfilled this in terms of facing the powers of darkness of the other world, such as in his first vision and others like that. Third, the shamanic complex is manifested when one is called by spirits or deities from the other world to perform a certain mission. Joseph's call by Moroni, and later figures such as Elijah, Moses, and others, suggests his fulfilling of that requirement. Next, the shaman is that individual who achieves great states of ecstasy, wherein his spirit goes to other worlds and beholds other realities of heaven and eternity. Certainly, Joseph's visions, such as the 3 degrees of glory, qualify him in this area. The shaman also uses sacred stones or objects to see into the other world and into the souls of individuals for the cause of spiritual disturbance and illness. Joseph accomplished this as he translated the Book of Mormon. A shaman with his capacity to use stones to divine and see into the other world also has general psychic abilities such as telepathy, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, and the understanding of dreams. Joseph fulfilled this aspect of the shamanic complex quite strikingly. As an example, David Whitmer claimed that Joseph could read signs 160 miles away and tell exactly what was on them and what was transpiring in the local area. He was like a shaman you read about who find people in for the police. His ability to interpret dreams has been well demonstrated. Finally, the shaman is that individual who has helping spirits or agents, specifically special animals, to help him in his accomplishing his quest and mission. This aspect of the shamanic complex, to my understanding, has heretofore been seemingly found wanting in the life of Joseph Smith. However, with the coming forth of the Salamander Letter, the door has been opened to consider Joseph's special connection to the animal world. It needs to be emphasized that the shaman, as differentiated from all other forms of specialists in the sacred, including prophets, priests, healers, medicine men, stand completely apart in that the shaman has unique connections with animal powers that in turn are related to deity and the supernatural world. And so we turn to Joseph Smith and this most important qualification of the shamanic complex. With the background presented, we see that the task given to Joseph, that of healing his family, was formidable. How could he accomplish this functionally? Simply, he went from money digging, to finding a spirit, to encountering a sacred animal, to finding a treasure, to being led to an angel, to finding some plates, to producing a religious scripture. How was magic transformed into religion? Let us look at this more carefully. And I would refer you now to the chart, to the other side, and I'd like to have you highlight that chart as I go through the rest of the discussion, because this is the central concept of my paper I want to try to bring home. If the purported Oliver Cowdery history of the church, not yet fully available, is true, there is a suggestion that Alvin located the buried gold and treasure with a seer stone. It is mentioned that a salamander appeared on 3 occasions, once to Alvin and twice to Joseph. It is alleged that Alvin was overcome by enchantment and could not get the treasure. In the 1830 Martin Harris letter, the following is noted, and here is the famous 1830 letter. In the fall of the year 1827, I hear Joseph Smith found a gold Bible. I take Joseph aside, and he says it is true. I found it 4 years ago with my stone, but only just got it because of the enchantment. The old spirit come to me 3 times in the same dream and says, dig up the gold. But when I take it up the next morning, the spirit transfigured himself from a white salamander in the bottom of the hole and struck me 3 times and held the treasure and would not let me have it because I lay it down to cover over the hole when the spirit says, do not lay it down. Joseph says, when can I have it? The spirit says, 1 year from today if you obey me. Look to the stone. After a few days, he looks. The spirit says, bring your brother Alvin. Joseph says, he is dead. Shall I bring what remains? But the spirit is gone. Joseph goes to get the gold Bible, but the spirit says, you did not bring your brother. You cannot have it. Look to the stone. Joseph looks, but cannot see who to bring. The spirit says, I tricked you again. Look to the stone. Joseph looks and sees his wife. In shamanic cultures, stones are often acquainted with the bones of particular ancestors, important ones who have died. In the bones, the soul resides. Hence, they are seen as the most valuable parts of an individual. This vision compares very closely in certain fundamental aspects with the initial vision of his father in 1811, who also went after a treasure in the field. The animals prohibited him from taking it. So too, when Joseph Jr. attempted to get the plates, an animal, a white salamander, prohibited him. It is as though the records slipped away or were taken away. The theme of the slippery treasure is prominent. Lucy Maxsmith confirms the same aspect of the Martin Harris letter. She noted that Joseph had it cross his mind that there might be something more in the box that would benefit him from a materialistic point of view. This whole chain of events, the stone, the hole or box in the ground, seeking for the treasure, the involvement with the spirit coming from the stone, and then the appearance of an animal, all suggest a universal shamanic theme in finding great treasures. The image of a white salamander, though, seems the most mysterious element of all in this account of Joseph's finding the treasure as reported by Harris. What is the white salamander? Its whiteness suggests that it would be an unusual form of the animal, in effect, a totem animal. For understanding young Joseph's experience with the salamander, however, the following 2 dreams by modern-day individuals suggest to me what is more cogent. A middle-aged woman was reflecting and meditating about what was elusive and unattainable for her in life, her self-realization. During this period, she had a dream. I am on a fishing trip, and in the process, put my hand in the water to reach for a fish. I get hold of a salamander that slips out of my hand. It eludes me. The dream suggests the quality of slipperiness. It points to that which is unattainable. In applying this dream to the life of Joseph Sr., it is clear that the treasure he sought for and had in hand always seemed to slip away. Was it because he was only seeking tangible treasure? In a second dream, a young man searching for answers in his life had the following dream. I am in the water and I see a lizard-like creature, like a white salamander. I reach out to take hold of it, but in doing so, I tear off its head. Out of the head comes a strange, dark, black, inky fluid. It looks like ink one could write a book. He reflected on this in terms of writing and reflection and meditation. These 2 dreams of 20th century individuals suggest to me the pattern of what I feel was so profoundly experienced by Joseph Jr. Could it be that the white salamander, as a mythological totem animal for Joseph, help him make the transition from a material to a spiritual meaning of the treasure? That is, from gold digging and plates and treasures to writing a sacred book? What corroborates further is the aspect of Joseph's experience which intertwines with that of his father's final vision, in which he was told he lacked one thing for salvation. And that one thing was to be written down on a piece of paper. Could it be said that the treasure Joseph Sr. was looking for was not the literal gold in the ground, but the spiritual gold of the book written on paper? Thus, the spiritual side of this treasure, the gold plates, would finally express the real meaning for his father as well as young Joseph himself. Through writing the Book of Mormon with its message, a spiritual treasure was unearthed. The salamander would symbolize then the slippery treasure hard to obtain. It refers to the whole meaning of finding the spiritual experience that will save one's soul. In further amplifying the image of the white salamander, a totem animal in shamanic cultures is one who carries special powers related to the understanding of life and death and nature. Lizards, and a salamander is a lizard, particularly are seen as animals with a spirit of prophecy. The salamander specifically lives in water and land, thus suggesting the ability to transform from one sphere of existence to another. Spiritually, this connotes moving freely between heaven and earth. What's more, the only person able to get access to the power of such a special animal is the shaman, who can transform himself into the animal or see the animal in vision as an aid and a guide. More accurately, the shaman will often find that he can enlist the animal as his totem spirit and guide, who in turn will make available all the secrets of heaven and earth, particularly those concerning ancestor spirits and the design of the gods. Psychologically, one would say the shaman must of necessity descend to the level of his deepest animal nature and acquire the power and strength which enables him to transform his mortal limitation and perform godlike feats. And one of these feats is the finding and saving of one's ancestors. As noted previously, Joseph was grief-stricken in his loss of Alvin. He continued his search for the treasure because it represented and reminded him of his brother. Obtaining the treasure almost represented recouping that loss. Looking at Joseph as a shamanic personality, he went in his vision via the stone to a white salamander who in turn became a spirit that struck Joseph three times and held the treasure. Apparently this related to Joseph's laying the treasure down, contrary to instructions wherein he may have been tempted to take and get material gain from the treasure. In the Harris account, it is the old spirit who dealt with Joseph. He would be equivalent to the Lord, thus revealing his stature and deity. In his studies of the archetype of initiation in cultural context, Henderson, who worked with Jung, saw the God image as a given imprint present at birth within the human soul. The expression of the God image is very different depending on the cultural background of the individuals concerned. In dreams, fantasies, and visions, one finds a wide variety of expressions of the God image, which are related to the quest for psychic wholeness or fulfillment. At one end of the spectrum is the primal God image, in which deity is expressed principally in the elemental, primitive forms, often associated with animal, plant, and inanimate kingdoms. At the other end is the ultimate God image, where he is expressed in such form as an exalted man or spirit. What is of great significance is the fact that of all the special kinds of individuals, the shaman is that special one who almost at will crosses an invisible threshold in which his form of initiation and his form of healing and synthesis provides a connection with the primal God image and the ultimate God image directly and virtually simultaneously. He, of all other intermediaries, has the capacity to unite the most polar of all opposites. It is within the shaman's ability to synthesize these polarities of God by taking the elemental and the primitive, and at times horrifying and repugnant, and transforming them through the symbolic change into the sublime and beautiful expressions of God. While some may view this as tricksterism, it is in fact part of an artistic and creative process of the highest order. In all this, I'm claiming, Joseph took some of the most primitive elements of his unconscious world and utilized them through the symbolic process to create a bridge to a highly spiritual and religious world. This was done unconsciously. The salamander turned spirit later transformed himself into Moroni. He led Joseph to the Book of Mormon, itself another story in which the son saved the father or became a link to another world to save his father and his generation. Mormon, like Joseph Sr., had written of many spiritual experiences. Moroni, like Joseph Jr., transformed them into a new world of meaning. In the Harris letter, after a few days, Joseph apparently went to get the plates again. Most likely after the death of Alvin. The Spirit told him to bring Alvin. It appears that the Spirit did not know Alvin was dead. Joseph said he was dead and offered to bring his remains or his bones. Imagine that. Shamanically, the Spirit seemed to be requiring Alvin's bones as a price for the treasure. Bones symbolize the soul or the eternal part of the person. Thus, Joseph in vision was virtually functioning at a primitive level of mentation as though he were existing in a shaman's world. The Spirit's reaction seemed to suggest he does not know Alvin is dead. However, he may have been testing Joseph. He may have been asking what the treasure was worth. The most precious object to Joseph was Alvin. So it could be said the Spirit was testing Joseph to see if he would give the equivalent of his Joseph's soul, which would be his brother Alvin's soul. This would indeed be a test of sacrifice. Perhaps it was Joseph, like a shaman, who tried to exhume Alvin's bones to pay the price for asking the treasure, thus sacrificing all. The rumor of someone exhuming Alvin's bones may have come through Joseph telling this very story. Bones of great men, particularly the skulls, have often been used to communicate and deal with the gods. For what was most likely a later visit to the hill, Cumorah, Joseph was directed by the Spirit to bring his wife Emma. Emma was the replacement, you may recall, in Joseph's affection for the loss of Alvin. Thus, the Spirit testing him asked for someone alive he could bring. Perhaps it was the Spirit's way of saying Joseph had passed the final test and was now worthy to receive the treasure. He had finally come to appreciate that the treasure was not gold for material gain, but a book to be translated to save souls, to be used for spiritual ends. It also, at an emotional level, represents a remarkable completion of the mourning process by having Emma become the replacement for the loss of Alvin. Further, the significance of Alvin for Joseph is even more emphasized by Joseph's vision of the celestial kingdom recorded in 1836. In that vision, he saw his father, mother, and Alvin in the celestial kingdom, along with the great patriarchs. Joseph marveled that he saw Alvin there, seeing that he had departed this life before having been baptized for the remission of sins. As Brent Metcalf noted, that statement alone suggests that Alvin most likely believed the minister who thought Alvin had gone to hell. That is, because Alvin had not been baptized, he was in hell. In fact, this vision was an answer to that minister's accusation. For following that in vision, Joseph heard the voice of the Lord now say, "All who have died without knowledge of this gospel, who would have received it if they had been permitted to tarry, shall be heirs of the celestial kingdom of God." This suggests an unconscious Mormon overkill, and to me, noting the great significance of Alvin for Joseph and the family. An even more intriguing historical note is that in one account, Joseph put off certain people who wanted to see the plates sometime between 1824 and 1827 after his visits to the hill by saying the plates would first be seen and translated by his firstborn son at the age of 3. It is most interesting that Joseph and Emma married in 1827, and their firstborn child was born 19 June 1828, some 3 days short of 9 months from the time when Joseph apparently got the plates on 22 September 1827. It is also significant that this firstborn son was named Alvin. Also, the age of 3 would be the time from Alvin's death when apparently that statement was made by Joseph in 1827. Some feel that to integrate the primitive elements of Joseph's experiences with the sublime does not seem reasonable or possible, and so must be repugnant trickery. In my opinion, the most comprehensive view is one of seeing him as a shamanic personality who actually traversed the path to unite these disparate opposites. Healing and curing through vision and trance were his methodology. In the end, Joseph literally did save his father from his problem with alcohol, his depressions, his economic woes, and in his spiritual life. His father came into the church to find remission for his sins. Joseph was able to save his mother. He found for her the true church, what she was seeking, and the fulfillment to her early spiritual experiences. In addition, he helped unite her with his father so that they could become an intact and complete family. Beyond that, he saved his whole family, including himself, in his own spiritual crises. He became a leader for a new generation of people. He became a savior to many. He was indeed a shaman and healer, offering with Alvin a way to save our ancestors. In 1837, a fight erupted between Joseph and his brother William, and the latter said, "I am going to expose you," perhaps alluding to his earlier life of money digging, alcohol, and who knows what. Joseph answered, "You can't. I've saved the family." Indeed, that was significant. Indeed, Joseph Smith did just that. Thus, he was a seer of modern times. I would call him a great shaman, indeed a prophet. Thank you.
Are we ready for a seventh inning stretch, or should we go ahead? Would you like to stand for a minute? Let's do it.
Okay, well, shall we proceed and leave a little time for questions? It does indeed appear that Joseph Smith's positive involvement in treasure witching is a fact, as we've just heard. Well, how's that? Is that close? All right. Please shout again if it gets away, will you? I appreciate that. I'll repeat then, it does appear that Joseph Smith's positive involvement in treasure witching is a fact. Professor Walker has pointed out that Joseph Smith can be fully associated with the folk magic of the 1820s by many sources, not simply by the two letters, the 1830 Salamander letter and the 1825 letter of Joseph Smith, which have brought things to a head recently. I will point out that Richard L. Bushman in Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, an excellent recent study, associates Joseph with the superstitious money diggers of Palmyra, as we might expect. The teenage Joseph is shown to have had the gift of visions through a seer stone. Which gift to use to help enthusiastic associates locate buried treasure? Among such associates was his own father, as we've just heard. Bushman points this out, too. Bushman portrays Joseph as being reluctantly involved in treasure hunting, as if he sensed the misuse of his divine gift of seeing. Ironically, Bushman has found it valid, as Professor Walker has found it, to use the same data which anti-Mormon historian Fawn Brody employed in No Man Knows My History. And so it's interesting that her book, which has been vilified for decades, basically is based upon the, utilizes the same sources that now faithful historians will be using and are using. Bushman does attempt to preserve the integrity of the 1838 version of Joseph Smith's story by reconciling its account of Moroni and the plates with Joseph's treasure hunting. The Harris letter, announced too late for Bushman's consideration, does considerable damage to that attempted reconciliation since it substitutes a hostile spirit salamander for the angel Moroni. One supposes that Martin Harris, writing in 1830, would not have lied or made a mistake on this matter, and I think we've heard a good explanation, a greater elaboration on that just a moment ago. The 1825 Joseph Smith letter is equally unsettling because it, too, undermines the 1838 story of the first vision known and venerated by all modern Mormons. That story is, of course, discredited by other historical facts, in particular earlier accounts by Joseph Smith, which failed to specify the appearance of God the Father and God the Son in a vision occurring to Joseph in 1820. In the First Vision Controversy, A Critique and Reconciliation, an article published by Marvin Hill in Dialogue, Professor Hill attempts to reconcile the disparities between the versions of the First Vision story, chiefly by stressing Joseph Smith's incomplete, developing sense of truth and by depending upon the 1832 version. The rank-and-file membership of the church will find little consolation in his reconciliation. If anyone needs a reminder of the immense doctrinal and emotional importance of the 1838 account of the first vision, she or he may read James B. Allen's excellent article, Emergence of a Fundamental, The Expanding Role of Joseph Smith's First Vision in Mormon Religious Thought, in Journal of Mormon History, which traces the canonization of the 1838 account of the first vision. For me, the overriding significance of the Harris and Smith letters is that they intensify an already serious problem for the Mormon intellectual. Perhaps the large majority of church members will be unconcerned, having the happy capacity to ignore historical facts and cherish venerable tradition. But for the Mormon intellectual, for that person seriously attempting to reconcile faith and reason, the integrity, dignity, and prophetical stature of Joseph Smith, and indeed of his successors, are at stake. The simple fact is that we can't easily accept the young treasure-witching Joseph as a prophet in the making. Many Mormons will respond to the Smith and Harris letters as Claus Hansen, respected Mormon scholar, responded in an interview with a Time magazine reporter, quoted last spring, it's an incredible crisis of faith for me, said Claus Hansen. It means our historical foundation becomes a nice story that has no connection to reality. Historical fact assaults Mormon tradition in numerous ways. It is possible that there was no first vision in 1820, that Moroni was not attendant at Joseph's first view of the plates, that Joseph used his powers of seeing for the superstitious practice of treasure hunting, that the plates were never physically present, that Joseph translated by burying his face in a hat where he observed sentences in a seer stone, that he revised revelations many times after they were first given, that he engaged in unsound financial ventures, that he boasted and exaggerated in numerous sermons, making indefensible assertions and untenable prophecies, that he instituted polygamy in an unsavory and deceitful manner, concealing his own participation from the church at large. Consider the reaction of a thoughtful woman to a reading of Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith, a recent excellent biography. This paper was read at the Sunstone Symposium in Washington, D.C. in May. Over the last few years, says this woman, Mormon people have been increasingly battered by truth in our history. By the time we successfully push away our doubts and secure ourselves with acceptable explanations, another blow is dealt. Her latest blow has been, in reading Emma, the discovery of Joseph's deception of Emma regarding polygamy, a discovery which has shaken her confidence in his veracity in other matters. She fervently requests, please don't lie to me for my supposed good. It makes life much more difficult. Please don't lie to me to strengthen my testimony. Most significantly, she says she has, quote, given up my intense desire, even my need for the church to be true. I now look with a new freedom to consider other possibilities. Perhaps that liberation is good for her as an individual, but it bodes ill for the church, which cannot afford the loss of its most thoughtful and intelligent members. I've alluded to the attempts of Richard Bushman and Marvin Hill to reconcile Mormon tradition and historical facts. And I think we've just heard another good attempt at reconciliation here in the paper, excellent paper we heard a moment ago. Surely numerous others are making similar attempts. Even if unsatisfactory, these attempts are to be praised. I would like to add my own meager attempt in the remainder of this paper. The Smith and Harris letters demonstrate the Latter-day Saints very much need a different concept of a prophet. Mormons have fondly believed in, have even insisted upon, the concept of the heroic prophet. In many respects, of course, Joseph Smith behaved as the people around him thought a prophet should behave, particularly in his later years, as his understanding of the role of a prophet matured. He was a charismatic man whose personal presence kept thousands in a state of conversion. They had only to see and to hear him to believe he was a prophet. He was an admirable, fascinating man, but under the close scrutiny of the modern historian, where his secret life comes ineluctably to light, he can't measure up to the ideal of the unflawed hero. He certainly is not singly responsible for creating a superhuman image of himself. His constituency longed for such a leader. They demanded it. And modern Mormons continue to thirst for a giant leader whose conversation with deity makes him immune to the ignorance, anxiety, and vice of the ordinary human being. It is a terrible burden to impose on a man to say of him, as John Taylor said of Joseph Smith in Doctrine and Covenants 135, that he has, quote, done more, save Jesus only, for the salvation of men in the world than any other man that ever lived in it. Mormons have insisted that revelation be instantaneous, complete, and self-contained. They want the entire truth, and they want it quickly. They don't want ambiguities and shadowy uncertainties. They don't want to admit that a prophet's everyday concerns, his interest in money, prestige, love, and so on, might easily get mixed up in his mind with the voice of God. It is unthinkable that when a prophet speaks, he mingles revelation with uninspired ideas and impulses. Above all, they can't allow that a revelation might visit a prophet when he is in his weakest mood, his most unworthy moment, his least admirable condition. They can't believe in an erring prophet. They insist that sin and prophecy are absolute opposites. I will draw an image that might be taken humorously, though I don't intend it to be. I see revelation as an ember in a manure pile, a spontaneous combustion in a soggy, rotting log. It takes hold in absurd, undignified conditions, which is to say it takes hold among ordinary human beings. God in his whim, in his incomprehensibility, in his just refusal to measure himself by human expectations, strikes his spark in unlikely tinder. It is one thing to believe in heroic prophets when our only knowledge of them is through brief accounts in the Old and New Testaments and the Book of Mormon. It is quite another thing when we live with the prophet from day to day. We urgently need to protect ourselves from inevitable disillusionment by lowering our expectations and allowing prophets to be ordinary persons. We need to shift from a bright fire concept of revelation to a banked fire concept. We must allow that revelation is a flame struggling to flare forth, a small flicker in a welter of incombustibles. One might ask if our prophet is fallible and susceptible to error. If we can't depend upon his certain word, then by what means are we to determine truth? The answer is that the church as a whole must determine truth, and it must do so through a test of time and experience by which it sorts out from among the many utterances, directives, and predictions that might be true revelations, those which in fact are. The hierarchical structure of the church is often beneficial, but often it exerts itself with a stifling authoritarianism. Latter-day Saints would do well to depend less upon pronouncement from above and rely more on the mutual democratic process for making vital religious decisions. Congregations vote on matters almost every Sunday, yet everyone knows that the voting is perfunctory, a mere gesture of sustaining the decision of the leaders. The First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve, which together have become and undoubtedly will remain the legislative body of the Church, could well listen with greater intent to the criticism and suggestions for change in doctrine and practice coming from the ranks below. In particular, it would be of great benefit to the church to develop a working concept of a loyal opposition. tentative revelation and experimental prophecy imply an adaptability to change on the part of the church. If we admit that the church is imperfect in doctrine and practice, if we agree that progression rather than immutable propriety is the principle upon which a church of mortals must be founded, then we should expect and anticipate change rather than resist and fear it. In its brief 155-year history, the church has, in fact, undergone hundreds of minor changes and a number of terribly major ones. One thinks of the Manifesto of 1890. Historians now remind us that the church did not really make up its mind about a complete prohibition of polygamy until about 1905. Michael Quinn marshals convincing circumstantial evidence pointing to the probability that Wilford Woodruff himself took another plural wife, responding to motives that sound suspiciously like infatuation when the aged prophet married on September 20th, 1897, a Madame Lydia Mary von Finkelstein Mountford, a Christian of Jewish ancestry, and he married her apparently on the Pacific Ocean. Does that imply that President Woodruff's manifesto was less than a revelation? Rather, it implies that God works his will despite the recalcitrant understanding of his servants. In 1890, President Woodruff failed to see in full clarity what the church in retrospect can see very plainly. If polygamy had some brief advantages in frontier Utah, it had only liabilities for a progressive church in a civilized world. In time, the church may well decide that even celestial polygamy is a mistaken institution, since it allows men a greater advantage in replacing their deceased mates. Similarly, the church in the not-too-distant future will likely ordain women to the priesthood, thereby taking another step along the road to institutional perfection. A concept of tentative revelation and experimental prophecy will also help pull the teeth of the militant anti-Mormons who continue to make much of the multitudinous errors of our prophets. One of their chief premises is that a prophet speaks infallibly. If we admit forthwith and without the slightest apology that prophets do not speak infallibly, if we rely upon the experience of the collective church, worked upon by the Holy Ghost over a period of time, as the final determinant for the truthfulness of a possible revelation, we have destroyed a principal argument of those enemies who ardently desire to kill Mormonism. At all costs, we should insist upon the right to change our minds. So I must say that I, for one, don't care whether the Joseph Smith letter of 1825 and the Martin Harris letter of 1830 become indisputably authenticated. That's a matter for the historians to decide. I do know that Joseph Smith had a gift of vision, and he came by it early. According to the evidence, he didn't really know what to do with it. His prophetical gift glimmered distantly in the depths of his consciousness, mysterious and incomprehensible. Judged by rigorous standards, he often misused it. He sought treasure according to the superstitions of his time. He engaged in disastrous financial ventures. He prophesied a new Jerusalem in Missouri and found himself and his church roughly repulsed. He took plural wives in an unseemly manner. Yet he was still a prophet. His prophetic voice set him and his people on the road toward a faraway perfection. I'm not ashamed to belong to the Christian tradition that he established.
Let's just establish a couple of ground rules. First one is that you must come forward and use the microphone so that everyone can hear the question that you would like to pose to one of our panelists. We would prefer that you address your question to one of the three individuals. If you do it to the group, I may have to simply request one of them to respond in order to kind of give it focus. Please be as specific as you can in asking your question, And Peggy has given me some leeway in ruling questions inappropriate. I can't imagine with all that we've talked about so far that many questions could be in that category. So I'll use that discretionary. It's about 9:30 by my calculations. Let's call an end of things at 10 if the questions want to go on, but we won't go on all night. But let's just begin with the first question.
This will be to Dr. Walker.
Can all of you hear that now? Is that microphone loud enough for everyone to hear? Yeah, you might hold it.
Okay, I'd like to say, first of all, I thank the gentlemen, all three. I'm not a member of the LDS Church. I'm coming from an Orthodox evangelical perspective. Perhaps my question will seem simplistic, but it's an honest question. And I'm glad to say that I'm not in the position that these three gentlemen are, having to wrestle with the events of the last days to reconcile everything that's trying to come forth. As I listened to Professor Walker speak, across my mind came the question, how dare the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, through the prophet Moses in the book of Deuteronomy, across the board condemn witchcraft, divination, and all occultic practices, and say that those who do them must die? Why didn't God tell us, just simply be patient with these Canaanite, Philistine, and Amalekite shamans and seers, and try to understand their culture and their background? He didn't say that whatsoever. I've listened to all of you gentlemen tonight speak of, I've got the terms written down here, involvement with magic and the occult, shamans communicating with spirits of the other worlds, Kabbalistic and spiritualistic terms, the founding of the LDS Church, the Christian magic and the occult. I've listened to you sincerely, and I mean this, sincerely, go from one side of the spectrum, trying to understand Joseph's culture, looking at the new view, looking at his primitive beginnings, and just going right across the line without hesitating, proclaiming he was a true prophet, he did found the true church, he did save his parents, being proud to belonging to the Christian tradition that he established. Yet Bruce Metcalf said in his interview, 5 times Joseph was involved in the occult. And Reed Durham in 1974 showed us, if we are to believe, that Joseph did have a magic talisman, a Jupiter talisman. Dr. Durham said that Joseph was involved in the occult his entire life. And he said, calling upon the celestial intelligences to give him revelations and decisions. It seems to me that revelations and prophecies can only come from one of two places from the biblical perspective. And that I'm coming from, that's either from God or Satan. And if Joseph Smith in his beginnings and through his whole life was involved in the occult, how can we believe that anything that came from his lips to be true? So he had spiritual experiences. So does everybody in the world have spiritual experiences. Dr. Walker, you said, how dare we treat the God of heaven with contempt to deny these testimonies? But the Bible tells us that Satan can appear as an angel of light and indeed will do so to deceive. And if by Joseph's own lips and by a Mormon historian's own testimony he was in the occult all his life, don't we have to say that his revelations and experiences did not come from God but came from a malevolent spirit?
Well, we're not going to have definitive answers to questions as broad as that this evening. But I would suggest that there is a Bible and there is a Bible. There is a Bible of traditional fundamentalist belief. There is a Bible which suggests that many of these same experiences and feelings that Joseph went through happened to both Old and New Testament prophets as well. And I don't think I'm in a position this evening to draw the line where the voice of the Lord, where the voice of God was speaking, where the voice of Providence was speaking, and those other seemingly magical elements that we find in the Testaments. We have Joseph with his divining cup. Is that magical or is that religious? We have Jesus himself using magical formulae. Is that religion or is that magic? I think the answer to the question can best be provided by saying that I think scholars are now prepared to say that we're talking about a continuum here, something that we can't bifurcate. That magic, white magic, we're not talking about evil conjuring. That clearly has been denounced in the canon. But magical formulae and feelings, use of Urim and Thummim, is this religious or is this magic? I think most scholars would say today that it's both.
Dr. Grossbeck would like to respond to that question also.
I think the question is an excellent one in the commentary. I would only say that if one studies the historical background of shamanism, one finds that virtually most major religious traditions have some semblance of the shamanistic experience in it. I think a great case could be made for it, as was alluded to, concerning Jesus and his shamanistic abilities. I would only say this at this point, that fundamentally in the remarks and question that was made is the idea that there's got to be an either-or. When original, primary, religious, spiritual experience comes, often it is not divided up in all these neat compartments. Now, I do admit there is such a thing as black magic, black evil practices, and white. This is a tradition. And I think there's a confusion in thinking here about evil and good as it applies to these categories. I don't quarrel with the statement in the Old Testament, but it's a statement concerning black magic. It isn't necessarily a statement against white magic. But I would only say that if one really wants to look at all the data, one has to be willing to follow into the depths of this primal process and see where it goes. And it is a paradox. It doesn't permit one to think only in the categories of either or.
All right, next.
I think that we are being awfully generous to allow someone to take such an attack on Joseph Smith as the former questioner has. I too am not a member of the LDS Church. However, I think that it's unfair for someone to take advantage of someone else's research on Joseph Smith and attack his prophet calling and be unaware of similar things about their own prophet, such as Jesus Christ. There are documents, I'm sure, that most of us are familiar with, contemporary with Jesus Christ, criticizing his coming from Egypt with magical symbols tattooed to his chest and other such things. I'm sure that the former questioner is unaware of the work of Morton Smith, in particular, the Jesus the Magician, and I think that before a person opens his mouth to criticize, I think that he ought to be aware of the neighborhood he is walking in.
Do you have a specific question for the
My
panel?
My question. Dr. Grossbeck, I too have read Carl Jung, and I wonder, Carl Jung makes a lot of the stone as a implement in the becoming of a prophet, in the God that in particular that lives within the stone, and I wonder if there might be a little of that with Joseph Smith also.
Well, Well, I'll only say time did not permit to go into many elements in my paper of this nature. If you look worldwide, again, into shamanic literature, you find there's a whole literature on stones. Indeed, stones do bring godlike beings ahead. I had one quote in my, which I'll have in my paper, which from the Huichol Indians, for example, in Mexico, which talk about how the stone actually brings the presence of the gods who have died, gone, and resurrected, and that the stone becomes a crystallization of their bones. Here the theme of the stone and the bones go clearly together. And I can only say there's a flood of material about this that is almost endless. And so that indeed Joseph Smith and the stone, the divining, all of this about the Book of Mormon, the spirit, the salamander, and so forth, is a very universal shamanic pattern.
All right, next.
My question is for Dr. Grossbeck. If my memory serves me right, I believe that the Book of Mormon, 2 Nephi, makes an important connection between Joseph, who was sold into Egypt, and Joseph Smith. And according to the book of Genesis, the Joseph who was sold into Egypt had in his possession a divining cup, which he apparently used. I wonder if you've considered this important, or what seems to be, anyway, an important parallel between these two men.
When Jung defined archetypes as well as he could, and he never claimed he could very well, it's kind of a nebulous concept. So if you feel confused sometimes in reading about that, feel at home. But basically, an archetype partakes of universal patterns. And Jung made the significant statement that when an archetypal pattern is activated, it's as though there's a magnet that takes place in human experience, and there's all sorts of simultaneous correlations and connections and experiences that begin to take place. And I think this is one of them. I think that if you read the life of Joseph Smith, you find a tremendously powerful identification with Joseph who was sold into Egypt. And so I think what this parallel you're talking about would be an example, speaking psychologically now, of this kind of pattern parallel. You know, one of the things that Hugh Nibley often talked about is he tried to go back and find ancient correlations to patterns in the Book of Mormon, which is a very, very interesting and stimulating and, I think, exciting way to begin to study the Book of Mormon. The problem I always had with it is, well, what about archetypal patterns? You know, do you get into a certain archetypal pattern and hence you begin to bring out correlations that you can find anciently and in many different directions? And this is what makes these kinds of interpretations about what Joseph Smith was about, how did he relate to Joseph born into Egypt, makes it very difficult, because you have an activation of perhaps a similar pattern, a similar spiritual pattern, as it were, and it's extremely difficult to begin to put those things into context. It certainly challenges the view of those who want to say, well, Joseph Smith just went out and read about Joseph sold into Egypt, and therefore he made up his own pattern. It just doesn't happen that way. And that, I don't think, fits. And yet you're left with this kind of data that opens a tremendous series of questions. And I, for one, have been reading the Book of Mormon with this new material in a very different light. One can find many, many parallels, not only with personalities in the Book of Mormon, but also personalities from the Old Testament, such as Joseph sold into Egypt.
Next.
Thank you. Dr. Grossbeck, back to these archetypes. Joseph Smith Sr., whom you've discussed, had a dream similar to Lehi's, where there was a tree and a rope leading up to it. What significance did that dream have in his life? And does the tree, is the tree have any archetypal significance in the history of religion?
You've asked several questions. If we had another hour, we could go into that. I talk about that dream in my paper. Yes, there is a very interesting correlation. If for those of you who would like to read some interesting material, read Joseph Smith Sr.'s seven visions. One of them is a dream very similar to Lehi's dream in the Book of Mormon. Again, here's the question of possible archetypal patterns. Lucy Mack Smith, of course, recorded the vision of the visions of her husband in 1844. And some have speculated that she basically recall the vision of her husband much in the terms of what was already written in the Book of Mormon. Others have said, no, this is a more accurate account of what the father dreamed, which would have made then a very interesting correlation of Lehi's dream and Joseph Sr.'s vision. And there's a lot of interesting work that I think needs to be done there. My own personal opinion is that when, for whatever reason it was, I think that that dream had some personal significance to the family at the time of the death of Alvin. For example, if you take that Lehi dream, and time doesn't permit going into it, but in essence, it is a dream in which the family united is partaking of the truth to the scorn of the world. And that is a remarkable parallel to the personal circumstance of the family when they were alone, isolated, and a minister saying Alvin had gone to hell. There are a lot more implications, too. The final answer to the question about the tree, that is really a very significant thing, too, because throughout world literature and shamanism, you find that there is such a thing called the world tree. And the shaman, for example, in some cultures, would climb the world tree. He would go to the underworld on the tree, and then he would go to the upper world on the tree and come down to this world. The archetypal pattern of the three worlds and the world tree, with the shaman being the one designated individual to have access to that tree, as it were, a kind of tree of life, correlates very nicely with Lehi's dream. In fact, with Joseph Sr.'s dream. In fact, Joseph Sr., it could be argued, had many experiences himself, if you look carefully into the dreams also.
Next.
Yes, Professor Walker, could you comment on Gerald Tanner's attempts to discredit the Salamander letter and on the Boren papers?
And the what?
The Boren papers.
The letter, I really am not in any position to discuss. I'm not familiar with that and really cannot share with you any insight. Mr. Tanner, of course, for those of you who have not followed the literature, has been very cautious in accepting the authenticity of the documents. And I guess my response would be, I wish to heavens we could find that they're not genuine. Because then we could get that question behind us and go ahead and answer the questions that are before us. And I think I tried to suggest what those questions are. I think the issues at hand are going to have to be confronted regardless of whether those two documents are authentic. I tried to suggest in my paper that the weight of evidence is in my mind at least, very, very compelling. You not only have contemporaneous accounts that are agreeing with that, you have document, you have the culture that fits so closely with what's being suggested in the various documents that we have. In sum, I would say questions of authenticity are really not relevant. We have so many other things that we have to confront and look at that paint the same picture.
Next.
Question for Dr. Grosbeck. Heretofore, the orthodox consideration of the Book of Mormon has been that of a literal translation from physical plates, which would have a story recorded in English words that were once recorded in some other language. Now you're bringing in a new idea. Is this an approach where we should consider the Book of Mormon not as an actual translation from a document, but a translation from archetypes in someone's mind, or perhaps a combination of both?
David, I wish you hadn't asked that question. I'd like to turn it over to two or three people in the audience. Well, let me just say this in all, trying to not skirt this issue. I, for one, in my own faith, and I think my faith is clear, that I have a testimony of Joseph Smith as a prophet. But my faith is based no longer on lineal concepts or linear explanations. I see my own life, my own religious experiences, and many others based on so many things that at times seem contradictory that they can't be, that they're not rational in a certain way. In fact, that's the way of the shaman. You know, the shaman, as Barbara Meyerhoff described, is somebody who can entertain opposites that are so contradictory they don't fit into the golden mean or the neat synthesis that we often like to pull off in our modern enlightened way. And certainly I have to face the reality that now, as I look at Joseph Smith, that indeed one can find, as one reads the Book of Mormon, hundreds, I think there will be. I don't like to say that many, but I've begun to document them. Many parallels, archetypal patterns, as it were, of Joseph and his father, Joseph and his family. And it goes on and on, Mormon and Moroni. There was one mentioned earlier, Lehi's dream. My feeling is, yes, we need to take a look at that. We need to look, using archetypal theory, but that's not the only thing. We need to take a look at those kinds of truths. My sense is that anything that will begin to enlighten and enlarge our consciousness is legitimate. And certainly, it may fly in a totally contradictory way to other explanations. And so I would submit to you that indeed, if one begins to take the ramifications of the shamanic approach and the paradox, the uncomfortable paradoxes that this creates in one's mind and heart, it's very difficult and very wrenching, but yet I think it can bear great fruit. Fruit that that I think in the end, hopefully, can create a faith that one can deal with. Jung himself wrestled with this, for example, when he talked about his own encounters with God. And, for example, just look at the conflicts Joseph Smith had, though he never stated them that way, in terms of his image of God. Was God progressing in knowledge? Was he an exalted man? Versus was he this universal great being who knew it all, knew all things? It goes on and on. So my sense is that, yes, I think we have to go into that area and be very careful of simplistic conclusions that in quotes explains the Book of Mormon, for example. Yet, for those who would like to take the Smith story that I've begun to present tonight and begin to correlate that with Lehi's story in those opening pages of the Book of Mormon, you will find some very, very striking similarities.
Next.
I think there are probably archetypes in every family here similar to Joseph Smith's and Lehi's, and that's an interesting point, but those archetypes perhaps could be generalizable across the board. I have a question for Dr. Walker. Was there a point in time where it was obvious that this white magical culture that you're describing became an embarrassment to the leadership of the church? And was benignly or overtly neglected as part of our history. For example, by the time you read Roberts and his stuff, he certainly doesn't focus in this way on it. And I imagine some of these things were available to them. You're talking not about these two letters, of course, but there's been ample evidence for many years these kinds of things existed in that milieu. So in your studies, my question is, when was the break, when was the if any, between the original milieu and a more scientific, materialistic type Mormonism that we see practiced and thought about today?
I know of no dramatic event unless it would be the publication of E.D. Howe's book in 1834. I think with the publication of that book, Joseph and early church leaders said, this is something we really cannot discuss. We simply cannot place in the public forum. Maybe then, but certainly there are moments elsewhere. You see, when you have that great dissension in Kirtland in 36 and 37, who is at the center? Well, there is a seeress by the name of Hubbard, who is using a seer stone, and of course Martin Harris and others are are drawn to this. David Whitmer are drawn to the Cirrus because she is maintaining the tradition of the Village Adept, I think. And I think that also is a turning point. I think as the church left Kirtland, Joseph understood that there was a need for greater structure. But no, there's no watershed. There's no line that we can draw down through Mormon history that I'm aware of, unless it would be several of these things that we've discussed. Maybe as they leave New York.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn your cassette over at this time for Side 2.
Certainly 37, Cirrus Hubbard. Hubble?
Next.
Here's a question for Professor Peterson. You suggested the likelihood and perhaps the desirability, in your opinion, of modification of certain fundamental beliefs or practices of the church, namely women holding the priesthood and celestial marriage. What would be the role of the current president, prophet of the church, in such a procedure, and how would you see that relating to the role of Joseph Smith in pronouncements of doctrine during his lifetime as we understand them historically?
Well, we might look at the 1978 revelation regarding the priesthood for all worthy males. That's pretty universally interpreted as a revelation given by President Kimball, the present prophet. According to the concept I'm suggesting, it could be 100 years from now that is reversed and declared a mistake. I don't think it will be. I think, in fact, that revelation was given the stamp of the hearts of the vast majority of the members of the church and will stand. But take the preaching of Brigham Young and his associates about blood atonement in the early 1850s, which became so entrenched as inspired doctrine that very sober historians like B.H. Roberts had to take large portions of a chapter to deal with it, defend it. Well, at last we understand that the doctrine is entirely repudiated by the church. I think that's very appropriate for time, the testing to take place. I'm not suggesting that the prophet and his associates in the First Presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve not be viewed as bearing more inspiration and being more receptive than the rest of us. I'm simply saying that they can't do it alone, and it's wrong to think everything should come down from the top. They need the ratification of the experience of the vast majority of the membership of the church over a period of years to finally confirm that something is indeed a true revelation.
Yes.
I have a question of Dr. Walker. It has been suggested that one reason why the church was faster than the Tanners in accepting the two documents is that the church knew by other sources that the story was also told elsewhere. Dr. Walker, have you seen the Oliver Cowdery history or anything that purports to be the Oliver Cowdery history? And if so, does it talk about a white salamander?
Next.
A major tactic in defending the Book of Mormon's antiquity has been to discuss the literal objective character of the plates and the literal objective character of the, or the truthfulness of the affidavit signed by the three witnesses and the eight. And now we are saying, or you guys are telling us at least, that these witnesses and Joseph and everyone involved believe that treasures can sink through the earth, and that there are protective spirits floating around in the form of lizards, and that these can transform themselves, and they can be nasty, and they can ask us to bring the decaying remains of our dearest brother and bring our wife on the autumnal equinox, you know, and the baby's born 9 months later. Obviously, they're living in a very different world than we're living in. And I'd like every single one of the panelists to answer this question, and that is, what do you personally think about the reliability from our standpoint of those people's judgment about the physicalness of those plates and the ancientness of that book?
You're asking the right questions of what it takes to understand what a shamanic mind experiences. And obviously, we, most of us, haven't. We live so far away from animals, from nature, from these kinds of experiences that I think the question to me prompts the kind of awe that it does. How can all this fit? Because the other story we have all grown up on is so different and so clear and makes so much sense and is so neat and tidy and clean and all those things. I personally feel that, as I think I tried to say in my paper, this is a way that great truth comes. I guess my main response would be, you see, we have split good and evil in so many ways. I mean, I think Jung's greatest critique, for example, of the history of Christianity is this inevitable split of good and evil. And he talked about the concept of the shadow. And I think it's precisely because we cannot conceive of a world where there's this kind of mixture of things to understand it. And my sense is that, personally, for me to understand it, I have to go back to some very personal, very disengaging, very psychotic-like experiences that I have had in my work to begin to understand this. Because it isn't neat, it isn't clear. But, for example, to have the question Dave Berger raises, you know, the non-literal question of the Book of Mormon. Yeah, I think we have to look at that. We have to look at that very clearly. How does truth come? And I guess I side on the side of irrationalism in the sense that these shamanic characters who synthesize that which is just beyond what, as I say, we understand, become the ones who create the very systems that we all so neatly waltz away with and don't have to experience. And I don't think one can experience unless you go back and are willing to go through those kinds of primitive experiences. It's the only way that that world can make any sense. Because my answer to the question, you see, in the question was the idea, how can you believe this? Yes, I believe it. Just exactly that. Three-year-old children, all the magical world, the plates, then the spiritual realities that came from those plates. In shamanism, for example, A person is not crazy if they believe in spirits or all these things that go on in this other world. They're crazy if you mix up the two. You're psychotic if you don't differentiate. And like Joseph Campbell said one time, what the mystic or the shaman does is swim and fly in the world that the psychotic drowns in. And that's what I think we have to do. We have to go to those other crazy sides, you see, to begin to look at that world. And for example, I believe that Joseph Smith probably, at least the evidence I have now, probably did that literal thing of getting his brother's bones and taking them to the hill. And I can only understand that when I read the story 100 times over in the shamanic literature and what that means. It's crazy in 20th century mentality. It's crazy in modern Mormon mentality. It's frightening. But it isn't frightening if you can look at it from a shamanic viewpoint.
We read these very long papers, and I'm sure that about 15% of it actually is communicated. So maybe I could just restate some of my thoughts that I express in my paper. Obviously, I'm very sympathetic to the notion of new approaches. Obviously, I'm very sympathetic to the idea of using archetypes to explain, to some degree, what's happening in the mind of Joseph Smith. But I also tried to make quite a point in my paper that as we bring new ideas to the marketplace of scholarship, we have to look over our shoulder to the old legacies. And as we combine the new and the old, we reach the synthesis. So let me say that I do not have problems with the insight that comes with Jungian archetypes. But I also see very much in the evidence such things as physical plates and not by just a few. We have Lucy talking about having those on the table and fondling, feeling. They're metallic. Martin Harris said, gee, I don't know whether they're gold or what, but Joseph couldn't have had enough money to have bought any kind of metal to make those plates out of. That was one of the affirming testimonies of Harris, that there was something there, and he knew the impoverished condition of the Smiths and knew that there's no way that in his perspective that could be explained. Now, we've got 5 or 10 of those. People who witness those plates, feel them. We have them at the Whitmers. Some will say that the experience of the 3 and 8 witnesses are metaphysical experiences, but those seem to me to be very special kind of experiences. They have got to be part of the synthesis. We can't ignore that part of the evidence as we become enamored with something that seems new and exciting. And there was another part of that question, my attitude toward the Book of Mormon. I don't feel embarrassed at all in declaring my faith that it is a revelation of the Lord.
There were many days, apparently, when Joseph was translating that the plates possibly weren't even present under a cover. Sometimes they were present covered. There were remarks by those who observed him that he could translate without the plates anywhere around. And we understand now that he translated by peering into a stone in the hat, using the hat to exclude light so that he could see what was in the stone. And he would see sentences and speak the sentences to the scribe. And the sentences would stay until it was correctly written. Now, if he didn't need the plates to translate, what the hell difference does it make if they were real or not? Now, let me revise the word real to the word actual. The Book of Mormon is a real product. I mean, it's an actual thing. It exists in the actual world. It can be handled, felt, and looked at. So you have that much. What would you do if you find sometime a letter, and there are suggestions that they may exist, some statement that's quite convincing, and the brethren at BYU will duly authenticate it, telling you on the part of one of these witnesses or all of them that they never saw the plates in any way except in vision, that nobody except Joseph could really claim they ever saw the plates as a physical actuality. What are you going to do about it? I think you, if the prophetic gift of Joseph Smith is sufficient, what the hell difference does it make? That's what I was saying a moment ago. What difference does it make? If you insist that you find historical evidence that the plates as objects of gold existed in actuality, you'll have to take your position and react accordingly. Book of Mormon's a real product, and that's something to respond to.
Next.
Daniel Patt pointed out the historicist nature of Christianity in such a way as to say that if the central event of Christianity, by the way, this question is directed to Ron Walker, so you'll know. Okay, Ron. If the central event of Christianity was not historical, then many Christians would lose their faith in Christianity per se, thus perhaps explaining some of the intense interest in the Shroud of Turin. Many people who push for the historicity of Christianity or in any tenet in which they believe would take the historian's statement of if it is historical, then it is true, and turn it around to say if it is true, then it is historical. It seems that at least in recent history, that has been the program of the LDS Church in certain respects, that we have historically pushed for the historicity of the first vision. When the alternative accounts of the first vision came out, then we didn't have the historical nature of the first vision as such. We have claims and counterclaims about the Book of Mormon as an ancient product, as reflecting ancient Mesoamerican or North American archaeology. Whether the plates were made out of lead, as Joseph's uncle Jesse asserted, or whether they were truly gold, and who was hefting what, and so forth. So we have a number of additional revelations that are put forth as historical, and many people have based their testimony and faith in the religious truths that the church has promulgated on their historicity. They are historical, therefore they are true. It seems now that in a statement that you made, Ron, that you said that religious truth does not change, I would ask, without the element of history to back it up, or if we must cut the knot between history and truth, because our history leads us in another direction from what perhaps some of us may want our truth to take us, how does one establish any religious truth? The Protestant Revolution has shown that what is truth to one person may to another be nothing but blatant falsehood. And that has resulted in thousands of denominations. It seems that the only criterion for determining a religious truth is how strongly one believes what he asserts to be true. This process results in the logical fallacy that Claybaugh describes as, this is the argument upon which I base my facts, in contrast to the rationalists, these are the facts upon which I base my argument. If the historical facts upon which Mormonism are based do not support present-day hermeneutics or truths, then how can one establish those religious truths except by his desire that they be so? And what can support, therefore, any exclusive claim of the LDS Church to religious truth?
I can only give a personal response to that, and that response would be this. It is less important to me personally what happened in September 1823 and September 1827 today than several years ago. I find my faith more lodged in the substance of the revelations of the prophet. And you're asking, how can we verify and how can we prove those? I'm not sure that we can. I think it is perhaps enough simply to say that that those truths radiate with me personally. I have no difficulty in accepting them, admiring them, finding them enormously worthwhile and beneficial. That is subjectivity, but it's the kind of subjectivity that I'm comfortable in living with and passing on to my children.
You want to respond?
I think we are going to have to get used to the idea that, in quotes, historical truth may have a number of determinants. I think of the of a little story that is actually widespread. Shamans in many cultures for many years were debunked as fakers because, for example, an individual would have an illness, a spirit in the stomach, for example, that had to be taken out. And so the shaman, while the patient was in kind of a trance or whatever, would put some kind of a bug, for example, right in the patient's mouth or his own mouth, either one. And when he did the cure, he would say, aha, here is the illness coming out of the patient's stomach. Of course, literally, from a concrete point of view, it's blatant chicanery. It's, you know, the shaman came with something and now is claiming that's what came out of the patient's stomach. Not until perceptive historians and anthropologists began to study closely what was going on in the shaman's mind and to begin to reconsider it. The shaman talks about, again, two orders of reality, whereby that illness has a spiritual reality and a presence and a form. And the shaman's explanation is that this material object is only the vehicle by which that more spiritualized form has to have for a container. Well, I like that story because it challenges one to say, what is reality? What are the levels of reality? Now, when I hear the plates talked about, as Ron talks about, I think there were real plates. What happened with these plates? Maybe there was a time when they weren't necessary. But apparently, almost like this simple story of the shaman and the bug to contain the illness, there's a similarity there. And where is reality? Where is truth? You see. And I think we have to look at that fundamental assertion about, is there a spiritual world or isn't there?
I think we have time for one more. Let's have Dr. Hawkins conclude with his question.
As I have listened to a number of questions and comments, my feeling, and which I will end with a question, is that oftentimes as we try and deal with Joseph and his contemporaries struggling with truth and magic and other things in their practice and in their life and in their religion, we need to be a little compassionate and realize how much we share the same predicament. It can be evidenced in, say, medical science. Well, let me rephrase it this way. those guys had to make a living and land and treasure out of the land and so on, and any means that they could to have enough to live with was probably pretty essential to them. Today we are dealing with health and other problems, and I have seen neighbors on my street using both modern medicine, some of which will look quaint in 100 years, like chemotherapy, where we try and poison one part of us faster than the other. It'll look like bloodletting in 100 years. Together with garlic potions and Laetril and all kinds of interesting stuff going on at the same time, so that we are heirs of this same predicament of science and magic and religion. The basketball court tacked on to the chapel is a manifestation of American competitive culture wound right into the religious system of today. And our basketball court should give us some humility in the face of divining rods. The question which I would pose then is this. Was Joseph conscious that he was an evolutionist and not just conscious but above board with others, that he was refining the concepts that he was working on?
Do you want to address that to any specific person?
I'll only say that to me, the beauty of Joseph Smith in many ways is he was unconscious of it many times. I think he looked back. But to me, the part of the great feeling I have about him is that unself-consciousness, that unawareness of where it was all going, the letting it all go. So I don't think he was that aware at all. Maybe toward the end he was, but I don't think so when this was all happening. I don't think he knew it. And that's why I think he said, no man knows my history.
Well, I would like to extend our thanks to the panelists and to you tonight. We encourage you to come back tomorrow and share some other things. Have a safe trip home, and thank you for attending.
Thank you, David.